And if it isn't Natan? Burke wondered, half-teasing. If you study the Legend of Origin, you realize that Natan is not a person. Natan is an idea that one person can make a difference. People think that Natan is Takaran for Nathan, but it isn't. It is ancient Lorinese, which was the original language of the Legend of Origin. It means the One.
The One what?
Burke asked. The one who made a difference, the one who took responsibility, the one who led others to fight injustice. Michael looked whimsically at the ceiling. It means whatever you need it to mean. He looked at them. You know, in Hebrew, it means gift from God.
What's Hebrew?
An ancient language from Earth, Michael replied. I believe that because Natan has so many different meanings, all of which identify the person carrying the title to be someone trying to do good for all, is why it is such an easy persona for people of all backgrounds to follow.
And that's why you're willing to follow him even if you're not sure it is really him? Burke said.
I'm sorry, but that doesn't make much sense to me.
Do you believe in God? Michael asked.
Burke looked surprised by the question.
I don't know, I guess.
Why? Michael asked. Have you met God? Has God spoken to you?
No.
Then why do you believe in God? Michael challenged. Burke thought for a moment.
I guess I'm hedging my bets, he finally admitted. You know, better than I'm on board with it all, just in case there is a God after all.
And if it turns out that there is no God, will you be upset that you spent your entire life believing?
Not really, Burke admitted.
Why? Michael asked, leading Burke to his own conclusions.
Because believing in something good is likely to make me a better person, I suppose, Burke explained. At least that's what my mother told me.
I'm just following your mother's advice, then, Michael told him. I am believing that Nathan Scott is alive and is trying to help us defeat the Dusan and regain our freedom, just as he helped us defeat the Takaran Empire. And in doing so, I am doing good. Or at least I'm trying to.
I see your point, Burke admitted. Either that or I'm too tired to argue with you.
Major Aran has sent word that the roundup of the remaining Koronari is nearly complete, General Hessen reported to Lord Dusan as they walked through the gardens of the new Dusan capital complex at the center of Ansuari.
Nearly complete?
There are still a few cells yet to be raided, the general explained. The major's numbers are limited, and he now has a sizable number of prisoners to guard.
When does he estimate completion?
Lord Dusan wondered. 2 weeks maximum. The general braced himself for a scathing response from his leader, but received none.
Very well, Lord Dusan replied.
My lord? Lord Dusan looked at his trusted general and smiled.
You were expecting a more emotional response?
Respectfully, yes. Yes, I was. Lord Dusan laughed.
Sorry to disappoint you, my friend.
He looked around at the brilliant skies and the lush, colorful gardens around him. All along the hills that surrounded the once-proud capital of the Takaran Empire, there were estates, office buildings, factories, all the signs of a thriving civilization, all of which he now controlled.
"Look around you, my dear general. All of this is ours now, and with it we will build an empire the likes of which will make the one that once cast our forefathers out pale in comparison."
Lord Dusan looked at the general.
"And all because I granted an audience with an old man selling miracles."
"Opportunity often comes from unexpected sources." Lord Dusan nodded agreement.
"Garelius Narkor, one of my favorites."
He looked around again.
"Everything we need is here, in this tiny cluster of stars. Resources, manpower, technology, infrastructure. Hell, even the food isn't bad."
He laughed. "Taking control is only the beginning," General Hessen warned. "We still must win the hearts and minds of those we have subjugated.
Peace and prosperity is the magic elixir that wins the loyalty of the human herds," Lord Dusan stated.
"Fina Dortel, a controversial.
Another of my favorites. Even those with radical thoughts and agendas can sometimes spout truths worth remembering. None could be truer."
"And what are we to do with the captured Koronari?" General Hessen asked.
"The same that we do with all those we subjugate," Lord Dusan replied. "Offer them a chance to serve the Empire either as soldiers or slaves."
"The Koronari are unlike most warriors we have conquered in the past, my lord. They are proud, they are loyal, and they are dedicated. Even in their retirement, they serve their world.
I am not sure they could be trusted to serve us faithfully. Do we trust any of the soldiers we absorb? Lord Dusan questioned. Not entirely, no. Then I do not see the problem. Even the most dedicated soldier's patriotism can be swayed if given the right enticements. Power, respect, financial reward. Every man has his needs. The Koronari are no different, trust me. Of course, my lord. We grant them the same opportunity as we do all those we conquer. The choice is theirs, Lord Dusan stated firmly. I will see to it, my lord, General Hessen promised, taking a step backward before turning and walking away. Lord Dusan took in a deep breath. The smell of the garden was intoxicating. The previous world they conquered had been an ugly place, cursed with a putrid atmosphere. Takara and her sister worlds were lush and beautiful, each with their own unique charms. The Takarans were truly masters at terraforming. It was one of the many Takaran technologies Lord Dusan planned to use to his advantage as he expanded his empire.
You need to get out in front of this, Miri insisted, before Gagliardi makes his next move.
What do you propose I do? Her father asked. Tell the public everything, that my son, their hero, put all their lives at risk by circumventing his own execution, that he stole gunships from the very alliance he founded, and that he is trying to honor our commitments to our allies, just as they once honored their commitments to us. They will think I knew he was alive all along, the president said.
But you didn't, Miri reminded him.
None of us did. Gagliardi's right, the president said, shaking his head. The truth doesn't matter. All that matters is what the public will believe.
Which is exactly why we need to get in front of this. Beat Gagliardi to the punch. We tell the public he's known all along that the Zheng ships that trespassed against us were a false flag operation by the Dusan to keep us from sending ships to the Pantorus cluster,
that he recommended a retaliatory strike against the Zheng when he knew they had done nothing wrong, all because he wants a war with them. He wants an excuse to get revenge.
That may not play as well as you think, the president insisted. Plenty of people feel as he does. They want revenge.
Miri plopped down in a chair, frustrated.
What I don't understand is why. Why does Gagliardi want a war now? Why not a year from now? 2 years? 5 years? We'd be better armed by then, wouldn't we?
He wants this war now because the Dusan have jump drives, President Scott explained.
What?
He fears that if the Dusan somehow gained access to jump-drive technology, that the Zheng will as well. And if they do, we will not be able to defend ourselves. Not if they outfit their entire fleet with jump-drives.
But we don't even know where the Dusan got the jump-drive technology, Miri argued. For all we know, they figured it out on their own.
It doesn't matter, the president argued. His point is still valid. Deal with the enemy now while you still can, or risk not being able to handle them later. He's been handed an opportunity to do exactly that, and even if the truth is revealed, he still comes out looking good in the eyes of all who want revenge. He looks like a hero who made the tough call, deciding to lie in order to protect everyone.
Jesus, Pop, you sound like you admire the guy.
In a way, I suppose I do. At least I admire his dedication, even if I disagree with his methods.
But what about the Dusan? Miri wondered.
Even if Gagliardi defeats the Zheng, he'll still have the Dusan to deal with, and they do have jump drives. The Dusan are not a direct threat to the Sol Sector, the president insisted. They have too few ships, and by the time they're able to build up their fleet, ours will be even greater. It will take at least a century for the Dusan to grow their forces to a level that would pose a significant threat to us.
Then you think Gagliardi is doing the right thing?
Not at all, the president replied. I just understand why he feels he must do it.
What do you plan to do then? Miri asked.
I plan to continue to oppose him.
And if he lies to the public and tells them that you knew about Nathan being alive all along and helped him with a raid on Kohara?
I will deny it, and I will tell the truth. That we found out he was alive only a few days before the raid on the Koharan Cobra plant, and that we knew nothing about the raid.
But you won't tell the public that Gagliardi has lied to them about the Zheng, that he's starting a war that doesn't need to be fought?
It may not need to be fought, but many will be happy to see it fought and won.
Will he win? Miri wondered.
If he strikes now, probably.
So you're going to let him?
No, I'm not, the president replied. But the truth of the matter is, if he decides to attack without authorization, I'm not sure I can stop him. I may even be forced to choose between fully opposing him and risk losing control of this office, or appearing to back him in order to remain president and possibly keep him from completely annihilating the Zhang.
You can't just roll over on this, Miri protested.
I'm not rolling over, Miri, her father insisted. I'm doing what's necessary to ensure the safety of our people. That's my job. Unpleasant at times, yes, but it comes with the territory. What you have to understand is that Admiral Gagliardi believes he is doing the right thing, just as I believe that I am doing the right thing. Our end goals are the same, only our methodologies differ.
This is wrong, Miri insisted. He answers to you. You have the power to fire him and without cause.
Which would instantly destabilize our military forces.
One of his underlings would step in.
And likely continue with the same plan that Gagliardi has. They are his underlings, after all, loyal to him and believing in his plan. Better the devil we know.
Miri leaned back in her chair and sighed in frustration. This is exactly why Nathan hated politics so much, she finally said, and I have to say that I agree with him.
The bad is necessary in order to accomplish the good, her father reminded her. A good politician never loses sight of that.
Burke had drawn the first watch and had sat staring at the landscape between the barn, the house, and the roadway for going on several hours now.
At first, staying awake had been difficult. After hiking all night and day, every muscle in his body was tired. But he had gotten into a rhythm, moving his eyes from target to target, then closing them for 10 seconds before repeating. He had even begun humming one of his favorite tunes to help keep himself awake and provide timing. He was actually quite proud of himself for handling his watch duty so diligently, right up until the moment that he felt the cold muzzle of a gun against his left cheek. Burke's eyes popped open with a start, immediately shifting to his left. His body tensed, about to spring into action.
"I wouldn't," the old man whispered.
"Fuck," Burke exclaimed, not quite under his breath.
Michael woke quickly, immediately raising his weapon and taking aim as the near-silent whine of his charge pack announced that his weapon was ready to fire.
"Touch that trigger and your buddy here will have a really big hole in his head,"
the old man warned in a calm and confident manner. "He's not my buddy," Michael replied with a similar demeanor.
"What the—" Cuddy exclaimed, also waking.
"That burner of yours will bring the Dusan down us in minutes," the old man warned. "This thing's air-powered. Not as deadly, but deadly enough. Especially at close range. Your call, kid."
Michael remained still, his weapon still trained on the old man, ready to burn a hole through his head and melt his brain.
"Who are you?" "You aren't Dusan. If you were, you wouldn't be sleeping in the hay trying to avoid the satellite sensors."
"No, we're not," Michael replied. "I'll ask one last time, who are you?"
"I own this place, so I don't feel the need to answer you," the old man stated.
"This gun says otherwise," Michael argued.
"I have an idea," Burke interrupted. "How about you both put the guns down and we can converse calmly, without a gun pointed at my head? Since you're all trespassing on my property, I insist that you lower your weapon first," the old man told them.
"Very well," Michael replied, slowly lowering his weapon as he switched its power off.
The old man watched Michael out of the corner of his eye, waiting until he had placed the power-down weapon on the hay beside him, before finally lowering his own weapon.
"Oh, thank God," Burke exclaimed. "Now who the hell are you, and what are you doing in my barn?"
"We're just innocent travelers trying to make our way back to Aitkena," Michael lied. "Our vehicle broke down about 20 kilometers south of here, wherever here is. We're just trying to make it to a transport station so we can catch a ride to the city, that's all. We mean you no harm, I assure you." The old man laughed.
"You're a really bad liar, son."
He looked the three men over.
"You're in charge of these two, that much I can tell. And that blaster you're carrying is the same type that was dropped by the Karazari during the raid on the holding facility in Aitkena a few weeks back. Now you may be travelers and you may be on your way to the city, but you sure as hell aren't innocent. Either way, I don't care to know more than that."
He looked at Burke and then Cuddy.
"You two got burners as well?"
Cuddy slowly pushed the hay back to reveal the energy rifle lying next to him.
"Uh-huh,"
the old man said. He looked at Burke.
Where is yours?
I think you're standing on it, sir. The old man stepped back and brushed the hay away with his foot, revealing another energy rifle.
You be gone by sunup, understood?
Yes, sir, Michael replied respectfully.
And if I see you outside of this barn, I will shoot you, for appearance's sake.
Understood, Michael added.
Damn fools,
the old man muttered as he turned to depart. Sir, if you don't mind my asking, how did you figure out we were here? Michael asked.
Your sentry here was snoring. It was so damn loud I thought my tractor had started all by itself.
Cuddy looked at Burke.
I thought I was wide awake, I swear. Damn fools, the old man repeated. Sir,
Burke called after him,
I don't suppose you have anything to eat.
The old man ignored him, shaking his head as he stepped through the crack in the barn door, pulling it closed behind him.
Way to go, Burke, Cuddy chided. I was sure I was awake, Burke defended. I couldn't have been out for more than a minute or two, honest. What time is it anyway?
22:30, Michael replied.
Really?
Burke said sheepishly.
Okay, I admit, I might have been out for more than a minute or two.
Tell me it went well, Commander MacLay said as he met the Admiral in the corridor outside the Fleet Command shuttle station deep inside Port Terra.
The President has his opinion and I have mine.
Then nothing has changed, the Commander realized, falling in step alongside the Admiral.
Funny thing is, I'm pretty sure he knows that I'll attack with or without his consent, and I'm pretty sure he's not going to try to stop me.
How is that possible?
It's possible because he knows I'm right and that we must seize this opportunity while we can. He just doesn't want to go down in history as the one who made the ugly call.
So he's passing the buck to you.
In a manner of speaking, yes, the Admiral agreed. And to be honest, I'm fine with that.
Surely he can't know everything we plan to do, the commander said.
Not everything, no. He's a smart man, but he's too quick to turn a blind eye to the evil that men can do. He always has been.
Then you're green-lighting the op? Admiral Gagliardi stopped in his tracks, looking at the commander.
Yes, commander, you have a green light.
Commander MacLay sighed, the reality of it still not fully sinking in.
Jesus, Admiral, are we sure about this? We don't have a choice, Commander. That's the irony of it. The President of Earth left us with no other choice.
I never snore, Burke insisted. He's not lying, Cuddy agreed. I've never heard him snore.
If you can't stay awake during watch, you're supposed to wake someone up to either help you stay awake or let them take the watch if able,
Michael said sternly. That's basic training stuff.
You forget neither of us has ever been through basic training? Burke pointed out.
Still, it seems like common sense.
To you, maybe.
I see your point.
Guys?
Cuddy tried to interrupt.
Perhaps the Resistance should create some kind of handbook for new recruits or something.
Guys?
Perhaps, Michael agreed, if for no other reason than to end the discussion.
Guys! Cuddy repeated more urgently.
He's coming back!
Burke immediately reached for his energy rifle.
Don't,
Michael warned.
But he's probably armed, Burke argued.
He's armed, Cuddy confirmed, still peering out through a crack in the door.
The old man was right, Michael insisted. If we use our weapons, the Dusan will detect the energy discharges and be on us in minutes. Besides, he gave us permission to stay for the night.
Maybe he changed his mind, Burke suggested. Maybe he's coming to boot us out.
If he changed his mind, it is more likely that he would contact the Dusan and win favor for himself, Michael said.
He's carrying something.
Yeah, a gun, Burke said.
In addition to his gun, Cuddy explained.
A bag,
he added, stepping back to allow the old man to enter. The door opened slowly, and the old man cautiously peeked inside before entering. He tossed the bag to the ground in front of Burke's feet.
Took guts to ask, kid.
What's this? Burke asked, reaching down for the bag.
About a dozen military ration packs.
Food? Burke asked, excitedly digging into the bag.
Some call it that, the old man admitted. I don't.
Thank you, Michael said respectfully. He moved over next to Burke, taking one of the ration packs and inspecting it.
These are Coronari issue and quite old. Where did you get them? I had family in the Coronari. They're still good. They've got a shelf life of like 1,000,000 years or something, or so I'm told.
That's true, Michael laughed. They do. This is quite generous of you.
"Not really," the old man replied. "I never much cared for them, to be honest."
"How do these work?" Burke wondered, examining one of the ration packs. "Press in the center to break the heat pack seal and then shake thoroughly," Michael instructed. "In a few minutes, the contents will be fully heated and ready to eat." Burke wasted no time in getting started, popping the seal and shaking the ration pack like a crazy man.
"U3 resistance?" the old man asked out of nowhere.
"I thought you didn't want to know," Michael reminded him.
"I don't, and I do.
Let's just say that we are not fans of the Dusan and leave it at that," Michael suggested.
"Fair enough."
The old man watched as Burke and Cuddy opened their ration packs and started eating with their fingers.
"Sorry, I forgot to bring utensils."
Both Burke and Cuddy made sounds indicating it didn't matter to them.
"Just thought you should know," the old man said, turning to Michael. "The Dusan have been making surprise inspections throughout this area the last few days, so you might want to have someone other than Tractor Nose here on sentry."
"I swear I've never snored before." The old man slipped back through the door, heading back to the main house as Burke defended himself. Cuddy looked at Michael. "What if he turns us in?"
"If he was planning on turning us in, he wouldn't have warned us that the Dusan make surprise inspections," Michael insisted.
"He would have just turned us in. Besides, he had family who served in the Coronari, which means he would likely support the resistance if he could. In a way, by letting us sleep here and giving us these rations, he is supporting the resistance."
"You call this support?"
Burke wondered, tossing an empty ration pack to the ground.
"These things are barely edible."
"You ate two of them," Cuddy pointed out.
"I'm hungry."
"Be sure to eat some of the caca bites while on watch," Michael instructed. "They'll help keep you awake."
"This is not my first time in the backseat of a Gunyoki," Loki reminded his pilot.
"My apologies," Vol replied. "My intent was not to offend."
"I don't offend that easily," Loki told the old Gunyoki pilot. "I fly with Josh, remember?"
Vol Kaguchi smiled.
"Ah, yes. Patience and a thick skin would be required for that assignment."
"A lot of patience,"
Loki remarked under his breath, as he ran another diagnostic cycle on the Gunyoki fighter's newly installed jump drive. Vol continued to smile as he checked his flight instruments.
"1 minute to the test area."
"I'll be ready."
"So how does this thing work?" Vol wondered.
"I'm not really qualified to explain the physics," Loki admitted, "but as I understand it, the jump field creates a bubble of normal four-dimensional space around us. The power is dumped into the inner field as the outer field collapses and makes contact with the inner field. The result is that the bubble of normal space and all objects contained within transition in three-dimensional space, with time being the missing dimension. The inner field, which is still in normal space where time exists, decays at a rate that is dependent on how much energy was dumped into it at the moment of transition. Once it decays enough to become unstable, the field collapses, which forces us to transition back into normal space, thus ending the jump. We still travel along the same path as if we were flying through normal space, but we don't experience the time it takes to do so."
"Thank you for that explanation," Vol replied politely. "But I'm simply asking how we activate the system."
"Oh. Well, you just put the ship on the correct course and speed, select the desired jump distance, and press the jump button. But for these tests, I'll be activating the jump drive for my console."
"And just like that, you travel between the stars," Vol stated. "Incredible."
"You already knew about jump drives, right?" Loki questioned.
"Of course," Vol replied. "Jump ships have been plying our system for several years now. I have just never actually traveled in one."
Loki smiled. "It does take some getting used to."
"What does it feel like?" Vol wondered.
"You don't feel anything," Loki promised. "And since the Gunyoki fighters are getting stealth jump drives, you don't have to worry about the flash either."
"Marcus Taggart said the jumps make his teeth hurt."
"Yeah, well, he's the only person I know of who could ever feel a jump."
"I wonder why."
Vol looked down at his console again.
"We are entering the jump test area now."
"Test control, test one," Loki called over the comms. "We are in the test area and ready for the first jump test."
"Test one, test control," Josh replied over comms. "The princess says we're ready here. You can jump when ready. Wait. Oh, and she also says I should stop calling her princess," he added with a chuckle.
"The young man does like to anger those around him, doesn't he?" Vol observed.
"Yeah, it's kind of his thing." Loki rechecked his console. "All systems show ready back here."
We're on the designated course and speed, Vol assured him.
You ready?
Very much so, Vol assured him.
Test control, test one, jumping in three.
Loki armed the jump drive.
Two.
He flipped the safety off the jump button.
One.
He took a deep breath and pressed the jump button, looking out the window as he did so.
Pale blue-white light spilled quickly out of the jump emitters on the Gunyoki fighter's hull, spreading out and engulfing the ship. Only a split second after it had started, the blue-white light completely covered the ship and increased in its intensity, but it did not flash. Instead, it faded away as quickly as it had come. Loki thought he noticed the stars shifting slightly, but knew otherwise. Their first jump had been only a few light seconds, which would have resulted in no perceptible stellar shift.
Jump complete.
Did it work? Vol wondered.
Loki scanned his instruments, checking and rechecking their position. We are 3 light seconds further along our course than before the jump, so yes, it worked.
Incredible.
Test control, test one, Loki called over comms. It took several seconds for Josh to reply, as he was now 3 light seconds further behind the test jump.
Test one, 0 indicators, Josh reported. One moment you were there, and the next you were gone.
Wait, we've got you now. 3 light seconds downrange. Go ahead with a simulated stealth penetration jump.
Test one, understood, Loki replied.
Coming about on a reciprocal heading,
Vol reported as he put the Gunyoki fighter into a tight turn to port.
Setting up for Cold Coast,
Loki announced as he began powering down the ship's unnecessary systems in preparation for the next test jump.
These ships aren't exactly designed for stealth recon, you know, Vol reminded him.
It's just a matter of reducing emissions, Loki insisted. Any ship can Cold Coast. You just have to turn everything off, that's all.
Not exactly sure I'd like the sound of that. Turning things off, that is. These ships weren't designed to be restarted in flight.
That's why they modified them.
I still don't know where they found the room for all of this, Vol admitted.
You'd be surprised at how much room all that broadcasting and monitoring gear takes up, Loki told him. Not to mention all that race commission safety gear.
That gear keeps us safe, Vol insisted. Hence the name.
The only safety gear you need in combat is your ejection seat and what you're wearing, Loki insisted. That and your shields. Trust me.
You sound like you've seen your share of combat, my young friend.
More than I'd like, that's for sure.
Then why are you here?
Loki sighed. To be honest, I don't really know. Josh asked, Nathan asked. I couldn't say no.
Even with a wife and a baby at home.
I guess that's why, Loki admitted. They don't have a home. Not anymore.
Could you not have retired and lived out your life on Coronair, even under Dusan rule?
I'd always be worried the Dusan would realize that I'd once served and lock me up just like they've been doing to all the Coronari.
So you fight for a better life for those you love, then?
I guess so.
It is why we all fight, Vol told him. We are now on the return course and at the proper speed.
All systems except the jump drive are going cold, Loki reported. The jump drive will go cold as soon as the jump is completed. Loki scanned his instruments again. Jumping in 3, 2, 1, jumping.
Again the subdued, pale blue-white light spilled out over their hull, quickly engulfing them and then fading quickly away a second later.
Jump complete, Loki announced. All systems are offline. We're cold coasting. The only things on are the low-power comms and the passive sensors, both of which put out no detectable emissions.
When should the Aurora be able to detect us?
Vol wondered.
I'm detecting them on passive, Loki replied. So they should be able to detect us.
They should have jumped by now,
Lieutenant Commander Kono stated from the Aurora's sensor station. He counted down as usual, Josh assured them from the auxiliary station on the starboard side of the bridge.
They're out there. I've got no indication of anyone jumping into the area, the lieutenant commander assured her captain. Not on passive anyway. Shall I go active?
That would be cheating, Nathan said, half-joking. Go ahead and hail them, Mr. Hayes.
Test one, control, you out there?
Josh called over comms.
After half a minute, he added,
Loki, how do you copy?
Josh looked at Nathan.
I don't know, Captain. Maybe they haven't jumped yet.
Go active, Nathan ordered. Switching to active sensors, Lieutenant Commander Kono announced.
Holy crap, she declared a few seconds later.
I've got them, Captain, off the starboard bow, about 10 kilometers and closing fast.
What the hell, Loki?
Josh called over comms. "Sorry," Loki replied. "I just wanted to see how close we could get without being detected. Not bad, huh?"
"Not bad at all," Nathan agreed, turning to look at Abby and Eliza, both of whom were standing behind the tactical station watching the test.
"Congratulations. How long until we can outfit all of the Gunyokis with stealth jump drives?"
"Our plant on Rakuin has already finished the retooling process and is just waiting for word from us to get started," Eliza said. "Once word is given, we can start installation on the first ship within a few days. Then we'll be able to outfit one ship each day."
"How long until you're certain of the test results?" Nathan asked.
"We still have quite a few more test jumps to conduct," Abby warned. "I'd like to be sure of the stealth emitter's long-range performance and series jump performance as well before committing them to production."
"How about we streamline the process with a compromise?" Nathan suggested. "Outfit the first dozen or so with the prototype designs and limit them to short-range stealth jumps only, and no series stealth jumps, at least not in combat."
"I'd prefer to conduct through real-world testing," Abby insisted. "However, if we can install data recorders on all the Gunyokis using the prototypes, I guess we could use that data to extrapolate and predict performance parameters for longer stealth jumps. Series stealth jumps, however, need to be thoroughly tested on a dedicated test ship, since there is much more risk of the emitters overheating."
"Agreed," Nathan said. "Make the call to Eliza."
"Yes, sir."
"Maybe we should have saved a few of those ration packs for tomorrow," Cuddy commented.
"I was hungry now," Burke replied as he lay back in his makeshift hay bed.
"If I remember correctly, there's a transportation station in the town a few more kilometers down the road. We should be able to pick up some food there before getting on the train into Aitkena."
"Where are we going to go once we get to Aitkena?" Burke wondered. "Our rent is more than a month overdue by now. I wouldn't be surprised if the manager already sold all our stuff and rented the place out."
"I have some contacts in the city who may not have been compromised," Michael assured them. "Once we get into the city, I can initiate contact."
"And if they have been compromised?" Cuddy asked.
"Then we'll check to see if your apartment manager has rented out your place yet. If not, I can pay your back rent and we can hide out there for a while until the Dusan give up looking for us."
"Do you think they know what we look like?" Burke wondered.
"Doubtful," Michael replied. "Our encounters with them in the tunnels were brief, and there was a lot of dust and weapons fire in the air. Even if they were using battle cameras, it would have been difficult to get clear images of our faces. Three average-sized males, all with brown hair, is likely the best description they have, which could fit just about anyone."
"The old man's coming back," Cuddy warned, "and he's running this time."
Michael sprung from his hay bed, picking up his energy rifle and moving into position to defend himself. Burke took notice with a start, following Michael's lead and grabbing his own rifle.
"I thought you said we could trust him."
"I do. I mean, I did," Michael replied as he moved into position. "But there is a reason he's running." Seconds later, the old man burst through the barn doors, panting.
"They're coming," he warned between breaths. "A friend called. They're two houses down. They have searched every home and outbuilding on this road. They will be here within the hour."
"We've got to get out of here while we can," Burke exclaimed.
"No, you must stay put,"
the old man insisted.
"He's right," Michael agreed. "If they are actively searching this area, they will have tasked either a satellite or a shuttle to monitor the area for movement."
"Then they saw him running out here to warn us," Cuddy surmised.
"Possibly," Michael admitted as the old man moved over toward the livestock trailer in the corner of the barn behind the tractor. "Unless their sensor scans are more narrowly focused. These properties are far apart, and at night a more narrow sensor beam is usually required for optimal resolution."
A puzzled look came across his face as he watched the old man preparing to move the large trailer.
"What are you doing?"
"There's an underground shelter that was originally a root cellar, dug out of the rock below us. It is big enough to hide all three of you and then some. The entrance is underneath this trailer."
"They'll see us on their hand scanners," Burke insisted.
"Maybe not," Michael corrected. "This entire area is rich with Terek deposits. Between that and the magnetic fields of that fusion reactor, they might not detect anything below, not even the cave itself."
"That is why it was dug into the rock decades ago," the old man argued, "to hide from the Takarans. Now help me."
Michael and Burke helped the old man push the trailer forward a full meter. Once the trailer was moved, the old man brushed away the hay and dirt on the floor, revealing a half-meter square door. He pulled out his buck knife, stuck it into the edge, and pried the door up, grabbing its edge and pulling it aside.
"Inside, quickly," the old man urged. "I need to get everything in here back in order and get back inside before their sensor beams reach my property, or they will know that I was up to something."
Burke was the first one down the hall, followed by Cuddy and then Michael, who paused halfway down and looked up at the old man. "I do not mean to sound ungrateful, but why are you helping us?"
"For my son, and for his son as well. No man should outlive his heirs."
"But you are putting your own life at risk."
"We all die sooner or later," the old man insisted. "The only choice we have is how we live. If I am to die this day, I choose to do so in a manner that would make both my son and grandson proud."
The old man said no more as he moved the hatch back into position, forcing Michael down into the hiding place below. He quickly moved the dirt and straw back over the hatch, and then pushed with all his might to move the trailer back to its previous position, before attempting to restore the barn to its original condition, hiding all evidence of his guests. Chapter 5 "Jump complete," Kenji reported. Aiden glanced up from his console and out the forward windows. The cargo ship, Prestipina, was directly ahead of them, already filling half the window and growing larger with each passing second. "Four contacts," Sergeant DeGatta reported over Aiden's comset. "Dusan fighter escorts, peeling off to port and starboard, turning to intercept us now."
"We are the bait," Aiden commented.
"We have a firing solution," Kenji reported.
"Firing plasma torpedoes,"
Aiden announced as he pressed the firing button on his flight control stick. Three groups of four red-orange plasma torpedoes streaked away from under their gunship's nose, closing the distance between them and the Prestipino in the blink of an eye. All 12 torpedoes slammed into the cargo vessel's aft shields, causing them to shimmer in opaque pale orange flashes with each impact. It was frightening looking, to be sure, and likely shook the crew of the cargo vessel quite a bit, but their shields held.
"Targets 1 and 3 are turning into us," Sergeant DeGatta warned. "How about somebody fires on them?" Aiden suggested.
"Roll 20 to starboard, Captain," Ollie requested over the comsets. Aiden didn't reply, simply tapping his flight control stick, pushing it momentarily to the right to initiate the roll and bring his port cannon turret to more advantageous angle as requested. A second later, the young specialist opened fire, sending successive bolts of plasma energy streaking toward the approaching fighters. The first Dusan octofighter took several hits, causing its shields to flash reddish-orange as it absorbed the incoming energy. She continued to pour the plasma bolts into the diving fighter as it too opened fire, causing the gunship's shields to flash as well.
"Forward shields down to 80%, Kenji warned. "Firing another round,"
Aiden announced as he sent another group of 12 low-powered plasma torpedoes toward the Prestipino. The first 4 torpedoes found the cargo vessel's aft shields, just as before, but the remaining torpedoes missed as the target rolled into a turn to port in an effort to evade the incoming fire.
"All 4 octofighters are engaging us," Sergeant DeGatta warned.
The cockpit was flooded with repeated flashes of red-orange light as the incoming fire slammed into their forward shields.
"Forward shields down to 50%, Kenji warned. "First 2 targets are in the kill box," Sergeant DeGatta announced.
The nearest attacking Dusan octofighter suddenly exploded as its shields failed, allowing the incoming fire from Ali's plasma cannons to reach its hull.
"I got one!"
she exclaimed in glee.
"The last 2 fighters are entering the kill box," Sergeant DeGatta announced. "We're out of here,"
Aiden exclaimed, pressing the jump button. Stryker 3 disappeared in a blue-white flash as it jumped clear of the engagement area. A split second later, jump flashes appeared to the left and right, as well as above. Red-orange balls of energy poured in from 3 sides at once, pummeling the shields of the remaining 3 octofighters. One of the fighters managed to jump away as the other 2 exploded. Then, just as quickly as they had appeared, the 3 gunships, which had jumped in and ambushed the remaining Dusan fighters, jumped away in blue-white flashes.
"Jump complete," Kenji reported.
"Coming about,"
Aiden added.
"Got anything?"
he asked his sensor operator.
"One moment," Sergeant DeGatta replied. "I've got the Prestipino still rolling away to port, and a whole lot of debris."
"Striker leader to all strikers,"
Captain Nash's voice called over comms. "One bandit still active, unknown position."
"The Prestipino is jumping," Sergeant DeGatta reported.
"Did you get her track?"
Aiden asked.
"Track and field energy levels,"
the sergeant assured him.
"Calculating her jump destination coordinates and sending them to you now."
"I've got 'em,"
Kenji reported.
"Turn to 157, 20 down.
Aiden immediately turned to the new heading as his co-pilot fed the estimated coordinates of the Prestipino into the jump drive.
"Striker 3 in the blind,"
Aiden called out over comms. Prestipino has jumped. We are pursuing. Loading jump plot now, Kenji reported.
What were the Prestipino shields down to?
Aiden asked.
Her half shields were down to 40% when we jumped, Sergeant Degatta replied. Probably back up to at least 60 by now.
Plot loaded. Jumping, Aiden announced as their windows turned opaque momentarily. Aiden looked out the windows but saw nothing.
Where is she?
Got her, Sergeant Degatta reported.
115, 5 up, 2,000 clicks.
Changing course, Aiden reported.
Plotting intercept jump,
Kenji followed.
She's powering up for another jump,
the sergeant warned.
Kenji,
Aiden urged.
Plotted and loaded,
he replied. Aiden pressed the jump button and the windows turned opaque again. When they cleared, the Prestipino was directly ahead, closer than expected, completely filling their windows.
Oh, shit, he exclaimed. A little close, don't you think?
She's jumping,
Sergeant Degatta announced. Aiden pressed the firing button on his flight control stick, sending 12 more plasma torpedoes into the cargo ship's aft shields. The Prestipino shields flashed with the impact of the first 11 plasma torpedoes, but collapsed completely just before the last one arrived. The cargo ship's propulsion section came apart, breaking away from the main body of the ship and spinning off to her starboard side, just as the ship's jump fields began to form. The spinning propulsion section exploded, sending debris flying in all directions and causing the Prestipino's jump fields to collapse before they could fully form.
"Target's jump drive is down!" Sergeant Degatta exclaimed.
"So is her main propulsion!"
Aiden exclaimed, ducking as debris slammed into their forward shields and bounced harmlessly clear of their gunship.
"Target is disabled," Sergeant Degatta added. "She's dead stick, unable to jump."
"Dag, send a comm drone back to the engagement area," Aiden ordered. "Let them know our location."
"I'm on it,"
Sergeant Degatta replied. Surprisingly, Burke had not fallen asleep. With a belly full of lousy food and total darkness surrounding him, he should have dozed off long ago. However, something was keeping him wide awake. Perhaps it was the Doosan troops who had just searched the ranch and all its outbuildings. It had been an hour since they heard the faint sound of men yelling back and forth to one another and stuff being moved about. It was difficult to hear much of anything since there were about 2 meters of rock between them and the surface. What little they did hear was coming through the switchback tunnel which led to the hatch hidden under the trailer in the barn. The bend in the tunnel prevented handheld scanners from getting any readings from within their little cave, but it didn't stop sound from traveling. Because of this, few words had been exchanged between the three of them, even in whispers. Burke leaned closer to Michael, whom he knew was sitting nearby in the pitch-dark cave.
"How much longer?" he asked in a barely audible whisper.
"I do not know,"
Michael replied in similar tones.
"Why?"
"I gotta pee."
"Go ahead."
If there had been any light, Michael would have seen Burke frown. A minute later, it was Cuddy who spoke.
"Seriously?"
he complained in a whisper.
"Can you keep it to your side of the cave, at least?"
"Sorry."
"Quiet,"
Michael snapped.
"I think they're gone," Burke insisted. "In fact, I think they left a long time ago."
"Do you really want to take that chance?"
Michael whispered. "Leaving one man in hiding is a very old trick."
"Why are you in such a hurry?"
Cuddy wondered.
"You gotta poop, too?"
"No," Burke defended, "but I'm not crazy about sitting around in my own pee."
"We don't enjoy it either," Cuddy replied. "Trust me."
"We can't stay down here forever," Burke insisted. "Sooner or later, we're gonna have to take the chance."
Michael sighed. "He's right, I'm afraid. It would be better to come out while it's dark, in case someone is still there."
"If they searched and left, wouldn't the old man come tell us?"
Cuddy suggested.
"That's what has me worried," Michael admitted.
"You think something's happened to him?"
Cuddy asked.
"I don't know,"
Michael replied, "but I intend to find out," he added, moving in the darkness toward the tunnel that snaked its way back and forth to the surface. After several minutes of twisting and wiggling his way up the narrow switchback tunnel, Michael reached the hatch. He pushed upward on one edge very slowly, straining his neck to get one eye into position to peek into the barn. There was very little light, just what moonlight was spilling through the partially open barn door. For all he knew, there could be several Doosan soldiers sitting on the other side of the nearby tractor waiting for him. However, if they knew he would come out in the barn, then they already knew about their hiding spot. If that were the case, they would have ordered them to come out or simply would have dropped a grenade down the hatch and been done with them. Michael lay there for several minutes, his neck beginning to cramp up as he looked and listened for any indication that they were not alone, but no such indication came. Finally, he slowly and quietly slid the hatch aside, contorting his body further to squeeze between the hay-covered barn floor and the trailer above him. Once out, he rolled quietly clear of the trailer and stood up. Michael looked around, checking behind everything, in the barn, large enough to conceal a human being. Once he was satisfied he was the only one inside, he pushed the trailer over a meter and whispered to Burke and Cuddy that they could now come out of hiding.
"Are they gone?"
Cuddy asked after climbing out of the underground hiding place. Michael peered out of the crack in the barn door, staring into the night, looking for any signs of movement. "I'm not seeing any movement. No vehicles, no troops, not anything."
"What about in the main house?"
Cuddy wondered. "The lights are still on, but I'm not seeing any movement there either," Michael replied, concern in his voice. "To be honest, that has me a little worried also."
"Why?"
Burke asked, stepping up behind the two of them after climbing up from the hatch. "The old man always turned the lights on when he entered a room and off when he left. All old people do. It's a habit they picked up during the original Takaran occupation, when electrical power was difficult to come by and expensive."
"But he's got a fusion reactor just like everyone else,"
Burke commented, pointing over his shoulder at the reactor in the corner of the barn. Fusion reactors in every building didn't come until long after the Takarans took over. It was one of the ways Caius tried to convince us that life was better under his rule. A lot of people refused to accept the reactors. I have a feeling the old man was one of them.
"You think they took him?"
Burke asked. "Or worse," Michael said. "You're the way we have to check on him. We owe him that much." Michael slowly pushed on the barn door, moving out into the open and heading toward the main house.
"I guess we should follow him," Cuddy said, looking at Burke.
"In here I thought we were supposed to lay low and survive,"
Burke grumbled, following Cuddy out the door.
"She's still got maneuvering," Sergeant DeGatta reported, "and her jump drive is still operational."
"But her entire propulsion section is missing,"
Aiden exclaimed. "Hell, a quarter of her emitters were probably on that part of the ship."
"Emitters are independent of one another," Kenji reminded Aiden. "They're all fed power through dedicated lines. They're just timed to work together. If a few of them are offline, the others can still form a jump field as long as not too many of them are missing. It just takes longer for the field to fully form, and they won't be able to jump as far, but they could still jump, theoretically."
"Would you risk that ship?"
Aiden asked.
"Theoretically?"
"Probably not,"
Kenji admitted.
"Multiple jump flashes," the sergeant reported. "Three of them, strikers 1, 2, and 4.
"Three leader, what the hell happened?"
"Sorry, sir," Aiden apologized. "They tried to jump away. We pursued and jumped in a little close. We fired as they were trying to jump away again, and, well..."
"Leader to all strikers,"
Captain Nash continued, ignoring Aiden's apology. "Move to overwatch positions."
"You heard the man," Kenji said.
Aiden manipulated his flight controls, moving his gunship to their assigned watch position, in preparation for the Saiki's arrival to begin the next phase of the mission.
"One is launching a comm drone," Sergeant DeGatta reported.
"He sounded a little angry," Kenji said.
"Who, Nash?"
"Yeah, Nash."
"Nah.
We weren't supposed to blow the tail off the Prestipino, you know."
Aiden said nothing, just glaring at his co-pilot, who seemed to be taking great joy in Aiden's mistake. Michael slowly opened the back door to the main house, peering inside. Like most ranch houses, the back door led to a mudroom which then led to the utility room, both of which seemed to be the only rooms in the entire house that were not lit. Michael moved through the mudroom and into the utility room, guided only by the light spilling through the partially open kitchen door. The utility room provided the first indication that the Doosan had been in the house. Cupboards above the laundry unit were open, the laundry bin was knocked over, and clothing was scattered across the floor. Michael continued to move quietly toward the kitchen, being careful not to disturb anything along the way. He paused at the door, peeking inside of the well-lit kitchen, but spotted no one. The kitchen was also in disarray. The table was tipped over, pots and pans were strewn about, and the floor was littered with broken dishes. In addition, the refrigerator was standing open, and it looked as if much of the food stored within had been taken. "Like common thugs," Michael thought as he moved through the kitchen toward the living room. It was not an uncommon phenomenon among conscripted troops. He remembered his own days in the service of the Takaran Empire. Stories abounded of soldiers taking whatever they wanted from the populations they were supposed to be protecting. He had even known one man who was quite methodical in his looting, planning to use his ill-gotten gains to fund his transportation home upon completion of his service. Ironically, the man had not survived long enough to complete his plan, and all that he had taken ended up in the hands of officers above him, men who were of noble houses and therefore did not need such trinkets. Michael moved out of the kitchen and through the dining room. That's when he saw something that made him stop in his tracks. A pair of legs, just beyond the doorway into the living room. They were at an angle as if the man to whom they belonged was leaning back in a chair with his legs outstretched to relax. Michael stood there for several seconds, frozen with indecision, the only sounds being that of his own breathing. "Sir?" he finally called, barely above a whisper. When he got no response, he took two steps forward, just enough to see the man's unmoving hands. One more step provided his answer, the edge of a pool of blood on the floor just under the man's thighs. Michael continued walking slowly forward, revealing the full view of the old man. He stood there, staring at the victim. The old man's expression told the horror of his death. His shirt was open, and his chest and abdomen had been sliced open with near surgical precision. His intestines were hanging out, and blood and bile were dripping from his severed colon. The old man had been tortured. Michael was certain of it. And it had been brutal. Yet the tough old guy had not given them up to the Dusan.
"Oh, my God!"
Cuddy exclaimed in a shocked, breathless whisper.
"Oh, fuck!" Burke added as he came into the room as well. "What happened?"
"He was tortured."
"Why?"
Cuddy wondered. Michael spotted something on the floor next to the chair in which the old man had died. A small cube which he recognized as a 3D image projector. He bent over and picked it up, wiping it on his pant leg to get the blood off. Holding it in the palm of his hand, he pressed the small button on the side to activate the projector. In the air before them was a meter-tall image of a man in uniform. He looked to be in his late 30s and was wearing the uniform of the Coronari, a lieutenant. Standing beside him was a much younger man, who bore a striking resemblance to the old man sitting dead in the chair beside him. Michael felt a wave of emotion wash over him as he recognized the man in uniform.
"Because of him," Michael said, answering Cuddy's question. "I knew this man," he added, struggling to hold back tears. "His name was Waddell. This man must be his father."
Michael began to lose it, squinting to keep control of his emotions as tears ran down his cheeks. "He didn't give us up in order to honor his son and grandson, both of whom died in combat." Michael paused, sniffling.
"He's with them now."
"What the hell are we doing here?" Josh wondered from the cockpit of the Saiki. "The Prestipino's main propulsion is toast."
"She's still got maneuvering and her jump drive might still work," Loki insisted. "If so, we could jump her to a safe location and wait for a tug to haul her back to the fleet for repairs."
"We're not even two jumps from the original engagement area," Josh argued. "And it's going to take you guys at least half an hour to get inside and determine if the damn thing is salvageable. I say we cut our losses and head home."
"Intel says that ship is carrying a lot of useful cargo," Corporal Eliason said. "Medical supplies, consumables, small arms, energy rifles, even portable fusion reactors. If we can jump her to a safe location, we might at least be able to unload her."
"Guns, reactors, medical supplies?" Josh wondered. "That doesn't sound suspicious to you."
He looked at Loki.
"Sounds like the perfect bait to me."
"Good point," Loki agreed. "I thought that myself," the corporal admitted. "But going over there now to investigate holds no more risk than any of the previous cargo ships we've boarded."
"Unless the whole thing is a trap," Josh insisted. "Let's not forget that one of the escort fighters is still unaccounted for. What if they went for reinforcements?"
"If they did, they left before the Prestipino jumped, so they don't know where she is at the moment," the corporal argued.
"But they will shortly."
"Which is why we should stop talking and board her now," the corporal insisted.
"This is nuts," Josh argued, shaking his head.
"Maybe, but it's my call," Corporal Eliason reminded Josh. "My responsibility."
"And it's my responsibility to keep this ship and our crew safe," Josh argued. "And that means not flying her into what looks like a trap."
"If it's a trap, then they're going to wait until we're on board to spring it," the corporal insisted. "So just get us on our way and then move off to a safe distance, like usual. If something goes wrong inside, you can jump away."
"Sounds great,"
Josh agreed with a bit of sarcasm in his voice. Except for one thing. You're taking Loki with you, and that's an unacceptable risk, since he's the only one with the training necessary to jump these captured cargo ships back to the fleet using our pursuit evasion algorithm.
Agreed, the corporal replied. Loki stays here. Once we secure the ship, we'll assess her condition. If she's able, we'll make another jump, rendezvous with you there, and bring Mr. Sheehan aboard. Sound good?
No,
Josh replied. But it does sound acceptable.
Fantastic, Corporal Eliason said, relieved.
Get us onto that ship, then.
You got it,
Josh replied, turning back to his console. As soon as the corporal left the Seiki's bridge, Loki spoke up.
Thanks. I really did not want to go over there.
I've always got your back, Loke, Josh replied. You know that.
After what seemed an eternity, Burke finally broke the silence.
We have to decide what to do.
Michael looked up from where he had been sitting, staring at old man Waddell's body.
We should stay here for a while.
I thought we were trying to get to Aitkena, Cuddy said.
Ultimately, yes, Michael agreed. But as unfortunate as this man's death is, his sacrifice is an opportunity for us.
I'm not following you, Burke admitted.
The Dusan have already been here. They tortured this man to death, and he revealed nothing of importance to them. Therefore, it is highly unlikely that they will return. We should be able to stay here for days, if need be, without fear of discovery.
What about their satellites? Cuddy asked.
If the Dusan have already swept this area, it is unlikely their satellites will be conducting scans any longer. Also, most of these ranch houses have sensor-blocking nets installed in their attic spaces from during the Takaran occupation. We should check that now, while the satellites are least likely to be looking in this area.
Burke looked at the old man's dead body.
What do we do with him? Maybe we should bury him or something?
No, we must leave everything as it is, including Mr. Waddell's body, Michael insisted, in case the Dusan return.
We're supposed to stare at a dead body for a few days? Burke asked, surprised.
I'm afraid we have little choice.
Could we at least put a sheet over him or something?
I'm afraid not, Burke sighed.
He's going to start to smell soon.
I know, Michael replied. Perhaps we should stay out of this part of the house completely. The two of you gather up what you can of benefit. Food, water, that kind of thing. But try not to change the way things look. Don't put anything away or touch or move anything that you don't have to. Understood?
I've got it, Burke replied.
What are you going to do?
Cuddy wondered.
I'm going up into the attic to check for those nets, Michael replied.
They're still not answering our hails, Loki reported over comms.
That's all right, Corporal Eliason replied. We brought a universal key. Pop the door, Inchin.
I'm on it,
the Gadajok soldier at the Prestipino's starboard airlock outer door replied as he attached his override device to the outside of the door controller. 5 seconds later, the red light on the control console turned green, and the outer door slid open, disappearing into the cargo ship's hull.
We're in.
Inchin and Gazin, the corporal instructed. The two Gadajok soldiers pulled themselves into the airlock, its artificial gravity pulling them to the floor so they could easily transition from floating to walking. Troopers Inchin and Gazin moved into the airlock with weapons held ready, positioning themselves on either side of the airlock's inner doors. Trooper Inchin leaned in just enough to peer through the portal in the left door as Trooper Gazin dropped to one knee to ready himself. Corporal Eliason and Trooper Mitchell also moved into the airlock, and the corporal activated the outer doors, causing them to slide closed. Trooper Inchin reached up to the control console next to him and started the airlock pressurization cycle.
1 minute to pressure.
Seiki Eliason, we're about to enter. Maintain a safe distance.
Don't you worry, Josh replied.
If any more Dusan fighters show up, bug out, the corporal added.
Yet another unnecessary instruction, Josh quipped.
We really need to get another pilot, the corporal said, looking at Trooper Mitchell.
And miss all this witty repartee?
Full pressure, Inchin announced, popping in her door.
Trooper Gazin pulled his energy rifle tight to his shoulder, readying himself to open fire if needed.
Inchin activated the inner doors, causing them to slide open, giving them access to the interior of the Prestipino.
Here we go,
the corporal said, moving forward with his weapon high and ready. He stepped through the inner doors, immediately moving left as he swept his rifle from side to side. Trooper Mitchell followed suit, moving right as he swept the compartment in a similar fashion.
The two of them moved quickly to the far side of the compartment, taking up firing positions in case anyone came through the next hatchway leading into the corridor. As soon as the two men were set, Troopers Inchin and Gazin came out of the airlock as well, moving straight ahead.